This is 5 o'clock shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network, originating at WBAI. In today's program, we take a look at the Supreme Court ruling in regard to the Affordable Care Act and its consequences in preserving the financial health of the insurance industry. We'll be speaking with David Himmelstein and Clark Newell about that. Also, there has been delivered to the Ecuadorian embassy in London a letter signed by leading members of the government, media, and human rights organizations on behalf of Julian Assange. We'll be speaking with the originator of that letter from Just Foreign Policy, as well as other implications of whistleblowing and freedom of speech. We'll be speaking with Thomas Drake, former senior executive of the National Security Agency. All that and more on today's edition of 5 O'Clock Shadow. I'm Robert Knight in New York. This is 5 O'Clock Shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network, originating at WBAI. I'm Robert Knight in New York, and there is a major global mobilization on behalf of Julian Assange, who is resisting the prospect of extradition to Sweden and then the United States, where he might be prosecuted under the Espionage Act. There are rumors of a sealed indictment. The letter was signed by many leading figures, including Michael Moore, Oliver Stone, Noam Chomsky, Danny Glover, and dozens more. We'll be speaking later with Robert Naiman about that particular procedure. But we are now joined live by Thomas Drake. He is a former senior executive of the National Security Agency and one of few people to travel the shoals successfully of a prosecution under the Espionage Act. And he is a proponent of freedom of speech and whistleblowing. And welcome to The Shadow.
Thanks for having me on your show.
In regard to Julian Assange, you say that it's important to know the facts of Assange's seeking asylum and not the spin. He faces grave danger if extradited as a prey of power. You said that you consider Assange the most wanted information revolutionary of the internet age. That makes him the foremost cyber refugee from forces of fascism. Can you please explain what you mean by that?
Well, it's clear that, you know, power elite, and particularly with the United States government, he's a wanted man. They don't like what he's done as a journalist. They don't like what he's revealed in terms of government wrongdoing, war crimes, and embarrassing foreign policy ventures. So he clearly has been a target for some time now. There's certainly reports of sealed indictments or versions of sealed indictments. We do know that there's certainly been a very wide-ranging investigation. And there's been a number of calls made by senior officials in our government over the past 18 months, calling him a high-tech terrorist, and he deserves, in some cases, the death penalty. Others want to see him in prison for many, many years. So he's a marked man, and I can fully understand and appreciate, given what I went through at the hands of my own government, why he would seek political asylum at this time.
As a veteran of the NSA, the National Security Agency, we know that WikiLeaks, of which Julian Assange is the founder and editor-in-chief and publisher, that there were the State Department cables that were released, which provided remarkable insight to the conduct of U.S. foreign affairs. There was the so-called collateral murder video indicating the operations of the U.S. military in Iraq and the killing of journalists, children, civilians, and such. And most recently, the Stratfor documents. Can you, as a national security veteran and expert, give us an assessment of the balance between danger and sunshine of these revelations?
Well, I'll answer it this way first. It's become extraordinarily dangerous to leak any kind of information that the government doesn't want leaked or does not like leaked, as well as whistleblowing. As I certainly found out, whistleblowing put me in the crosshairs of a multi-year, multi-million-dollar criminal national security investigation, which I was ultimately indicted under the Espionage Act. If the government's leaking it, with the so-called authorized leaks, apparently it's okay, although that's rung a number of bells in Congress now, I think, to the extent to which leaking for political gain was being used to make the administration look good and illustrate its foreign policy oaths in terms of what it could do. Frankly, there are true secrets that need to be kept. I'm certainly not a proponent for having all secrets released or exposed. You know, things like troop movements and nuclear secrets and of those type. But that's a very narrow intelligence agent identities. Those types of secrets are well worth keeping. But in the main, the vast majority of leaks are simply for political gain. Leaking, interestingly enough, has been mischaracterized and misplaced. And so I draw a distinction between leaking, as I just described, and whistleblowing, which is where you have a reasonable belief that the government is engaged in wrongdoing, illegalities, or is a direct threat or to public safety and public health. And so, or fraud, waste, and abuse. And that's precisely what I did in my own case within the system, and then I was retaliated against for having done so.
We will speak about your particular case because you are something of a canary in the coal mine in regard to prosecution under the Espionage Act, of which many people suspect that Julian Assange would be under the jeopardy of. But can you put the body of work of WikiLeaks in a historical context, going all the way back to the founding of the Republic, in terms of its utility for public knowledge and policy?
Well, I think history ultimately will say it's probably one of the most significant events in terms of the evolution of journalism and reporting to reveal the kind of shenanigans that many of the governments like to engage in across the world. You know, it's a shadow side of culture. It's a shadow side of diplomacy. A lot of the stuff that goes on behind the scenes is not all that pretty, and particularly when you're revealing for all of we hold ourselves up as the city on the hill and we have the moral high ground. Any number of things that have been revealed through WikiLeaks kind of puts that in a different perspective. And so Daniel Ellsberg, who's considered kind of the father whistleblowing in the modern era with the release of the Pentagon Papers, he said, he didn't have access to internet, didn't have access to computers of the day. He had to copy the Pentagon Papers, off on a on a mimeograph, basically an advanced mimeograph, for its day, an advanced mimeograph machine.
The evolution of technology is something with which the National Security Agency, I presume, is quite familiar. And you yourself, as a veteran of the Air Force, a decorated veteran of the Air Force and the Navy, which in my own systems career had the reputation of some of the smartest programmers in government service. And can you just take a moment to just give us a flavor of the technology by which information is gathered and leaks are monitored, and how that is a bivalent thing that can be used for populism or for repression?
Well, that's the kind of the dual side of technology. I mean, you can say technology can be used for either purpose. It can be used for the good. It can be used for the bad. It can be used to monitor. It can be used for surveillance. Technology has brought a lot of advantages into our society. But the same technology, particularly the technology that we're discussing with respect to digital technology, the ability to store vast amounts of information on a permanent basis of the equivalent of having what I would call a universal wiretap on each and every person, well, that raises the specter of what does that do to your culture? What does that do when the government in secret has that kind of capacity of being able to monitor and track on a large scale, far beyond, it's the stated purposes of sort of the national security establishment to provide for the common defense, in this case, the United States. It would seem that in the post 9/11 security world and kind of the security theater, we've gone far beyond that mandate. And we're essentially saying that, you never know when you might need it. We just need to get it. And so we're going to take it and store it and figure out what we're going to do with it later.
Our guest is Thomas Drake. a former senior executive of the National Security Agency, and also the recipient of the Reitnauer Prize for Truth-Telling, as well as the Sam Adams Associates for Integrity and Intelligence Award. And I'd like to now let people see how the Espionage Act works. And can you just take us through your experience as a whistleblower and your involvement or objections or participation with the Trailblazer Project, and what happened to you?
Well, I mean, when you imagine your life being, you know, become the target of the DOJ, the Department of Justice, you're turned into a bad guy. You're considered to be a traitor and a turncoat and one who's betrayed their country. And on top of that, they say, you know what? You violated the Espionage Act. It's the 1917 World War I era statute that was designed to go after spies, not whistleblowers. And so in this particular administration, you know, they've used that Espionage Act against six people now to date. More than all other administrations combined. It's extraordinarily heavy-handed. It's always been controversial, but to actually use it to go after people who had no intention on harming the United States or aiding any or abetting any foreign nation and turning it into a blunt instrument for silencing people and for censorship, well, if they can do that to us as whistleblowers, you know, imagine, you know, what they can do to any other individual. And one of the things that I live with to this day is I grew up as a very young adult, young teenager during the 1970s. I well remember Watergate. I well remember the release of the Pentagon Papers. I well remember the resignation of Richard Milhouse Nixon as the President of the United States, and that no one was above the law. I well remember the creation of two permanent standing committees on intelligence to provide oversight for the secret side of government, as well as a statute called the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. Never did I imagine that even in a post 9/11 scenario, where the government willfully choose to bypass that particular statute, as well as, you know, the Fourth Amendment and the Constitution, simply because of 9/11, that it was necessary to do so in order to make Americans feel safe again. When I know that the very best of American ingenuity and inventiveness could have easily provided superior talents while absolutely doing so in full compliance with the Fourth Amendment.
Thomas.
So there was a program NSA launched with great fanfare prior to 9/11 called Trailblazer that they doubled down on after 9/11, and it was going to be their challenge to meet all the demands of the digital age, when in fact there was already existing programs, one in particular called Thin Thread, that had already demonstrated its worth operationally as a test bed, was prepared to deploy well prior to 9/11, and yet was shut down by NSA after 9/11.
The collection of data by the NSA and other federal agencies, local and state as well, there's now kind of a new element in there, isn't there, with the cooperation of commercial enterprises that specialize in collecting data like Facebook and others, Google, that sort of is like an auxiliary of information gathering about individuals?
Yeah, one of the burgeoning realities, if not well discussed, beyond just government capacity, is the special arrangements that the government has entered into with any number of concerns, telecommunication concerns. That's primarily why they had to provide immunity to the telecommunication companies several years ago, because they had entered into an arrangement with the government to basically turn over and provide them access to their subscriber information as well as access to their networks. And that raises, when you have that kind of alliance between corporations and the government, the government is now vastly expanding its ability in secret to sweep up and analyze and parse vast amounts of data on all of the people in the country.
And facially identify them, and in future, that gives the possibility of prosecutors selectively prosecuting people for part of the data that they
They did with me. I mean, their entire case against me was totally trumped up. They basically wanted to send a message. I was the test case in which they wanted to establish the precedent for the equivalent of an Official Secrets Act. That's something we've never had in this country.
And
one of the risks, by the way, with this anti-leak hysteria slash legislation is it could actually lead to more draconian measures in terms of penalties for anybody that's considered to be a dissident, questions authority, or may have a profile that doesn't fit the norm. So that's one of the real dangers, in fact, in all of these scenarios. I lived it. I mean, imagine your entire life being peeled aside, that all of your transactions, all of your records, phone calls, every computer you've ever had access to, all the emails you've ever sent, all the tweets you've ever tweeted, all of your bank records, imagine the government having access to that and compiling a vast dossier of you at any time. If they choose to deal with you or go after you, they can.
One could say only half jokingly that the NSA is a contributor to global warming because of the energy throughput of the gigantic computer farms that are used to analyze LINT and SIGINT and other kinds of intelligence information.
Yes.
And I would be delinquent, Thomas Drake, if I did not ask you, what do you think is being done with the huge ranch of computers that NSA is building in Utah at this time?
Well, James Bamford had a very revealing article. He was actually a defense expert in my criminal case.
Of the Puzzle Palace. Oh, he's quite a great writer on the agency.
And he wrote an article called The Matrix that really detailed, and in some cases a follow-on article, provided even additional insights regarding this Utah data center, as they call it, that NSA is constructing out in Utah. It's apparently, based on reports, going to come online sometime in 2013. And it raises the question of why would you need a place to store all this data? One of the things that I became very aware of after 9/11 was I kept being told, because I was persisting on why NSA was going in this direction, when I found out to my horror that NSA was violating the first commandment that you never spy on Americans without a warrant, and had chosen to do so and turn the vast power of NSA onto the United States, essentially turning this nation into the equivalent of a foreign country for the purposes of dragnet, blanket, electronic surveillance, and data mining. There's so much data now. We're talking, you know, terabytes and petabytes and exabyte level of amounts of information. It's just staggering amounts of data. The call then was, we just need it. Just get the data. We'll figure out what we're going to do with it later. So they got to store it somewhere. And what's happened over the last 10, 12 years is that the cost of technology has dropped so much that I can literally put a terabyte of data on a chip that's barely the size of my thumb. And I'm talking about a really thin thumb. So the facility, based on reports, and no one's talking about it, obviously from in the government, not even sponsoring senators like Orrin Hatch, for example, because they look at it as good for Utah and jobs and all of that, plus, you know, national security. What do they need a facility for that's the equivalent of the size of five Capitol buildings? Well, if you're talking beyond the traditional mission of NSA, which is always outward-facing, if you're also leveraging access based on what you can get from within the country, they got to keep this stuff somewhere, and then you need to be able to have access to it from anywhere you want to, which sort of becomes the secret cloud for the intelligence apparatus. They got to store it somewhere. You got to store it somewhere because, in essence, there's so much data they can't make sense of it all as it's being generated. So they stick it in the desert.
So there is quite a dark future awaiting us as they pour through this information.
Well, that's the great concern that I have. I took the oath four times in my government career to support and defend the Constitution. What I was exposed to right after 9/11, to my horror, when the government engaged in NSA, became the executive agent for the White House super secret surveillance program, was it was taking us down a path that would be in direct conflict with the Constitution. And I believe that what we're seeing in terms of the rise of the national security state is anathema to the Constitution and is a clear and present danger to our future liberties. What's happened over the last 10 or 12 years is that the government has chosen to err almost completely on the side of security, knowing that they would have to sacrifice quite a few liberties, figuring that most of the citizenry wouldn't mind because the 99% of the citizenry and then some are completely innocent. And yet, in secret, they can, with little or no oversight, they can conduct these activities outside the purview of the public.
Well, Thomas Drake, it has certainly been an informative honor to speak with you today in regard to the Julian Assange case, but the greater issues of data storage and selective use of that information by hidden officials of the government. And in the minute or so that we have remaining, I leave you the last word, sir.
Well, during the latter part of the Cold War, maybe this is why I'm so concerned about the future and why I tend to be rather sensitive to the critical need of not having our privacies invaded and why liberty is so crucial, why our freedoms are so precious. I flew an RC-135. My target, the target of interest, the country I became an expert in was East Germany. They had a secret police called the Stasi. Guess what their motto was? To know everything, literally. That was their motto. And they were monstrously efficient at doing so. I can only imagine former Stasi officers who are still alive drooling at the prospect of what they could have done with the NSA technology of today.
Poindexter wasn't playing. We do have TIA, Total
Yes.
Information Awareness.
Yes.
Thank you so much, Thomas Drake. We'll stay in
You're
touch. It's been a revelation. This is 5 O'Clock Shadow. I'm Robert Knight in New York. We'll be back with more after this.
Pretty, pretty, pretty as a picture. Witty, witty, witty as you can be. Blind cause your eyes see only glitter. Close to the things that make you free. Never stop to think about a downfall. Happens at the end of every line. Just when you think you pull a fast one, happens to the foolish all the time. Somebody's watching you. 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 Games are to be played with toys, etc. Love is to be made.
This is 5 o'clock Shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network, originating at WBAI. I'm Robert Knight in New York. And as we have mentioned, there was a major letter from global movers and shakers, media, human rights, government, and other activists, a letter, a petition letter presented to the Embassy of Ecuador in London, where Julian Assange is currently residing while seeking political asylum in that country, to not be extradited, even though he is unindicted in Sweden, where he fears that the U.S. influence would be greater to bring him to the United States for a prosecution under the Espionage Act. And we had hoped to speak with Robert Naiman, the head of the Just Foreign Policy Organization, which was the progenitor or promulgator of this letter. He is at this moment traveling internationally. We are not able to make live telephone contact at this time, but we do have the letter that has been presented to the Ecuadorian authorities, here now mechanically transcribed.
Dear President Correa, we are writing to urge you to grant political asylum to Julian Assange. As you know, British courts recently struck down Mr. Assange's appeal against extradition to Sweden, where he is not wanted on criminal charges, but merely for questioning. Mr. Assange has repeatedly made clear he is willing to answer questions relating to accusations against him, but in the United Kingdom. But the Swedish government insists that he be brought to Sweden for questioning. This by itself, as Swedish legal expert and former chief district prosecutor for Stockholm Sven-Erik Alm testified, is unreasonable and unprofessional, as well as unfair and disproportionate. We believe Mr. Assange has good reason to fear extradition to Sweden, as there is a strong likelihood that once in Sweden, he would be imprisoned, and then likely extradited to the United States. As U.S. legal expert and commentator Glenn Greenwald recently noted, were Assange to be charged in Sweden, he would be imprisoned under very oppressive conditions, where he could be held incommunicado, rather than released on bail. Pre-trial hearings for such a case in Sweden are held in secret, and so the media and wider public, Greenwald notes, would not know how the judicial decisions against Mr. Assange would be made and what information would be considered. The Washington Post has reported that the U.S. Justice Department and Pentagon conducted a criminal investigation into whether WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange violated criminal laws in the group's release of government documents, including possible charges under the Espionage Act. Many fear, based on documents released by WikiLeaks, that the U.S. government has already prepared an indictment and is waiting for the opportunity to extradite Assange from Sweden. The U.S. Justice Department has compelled other members of WikiLeaks to testify before a grand jury in order to determine what charges might be brought against Mr. Assange. The U.S. government has made clear its open hostility to WikiLeaks, with high-level officials even referring to Mr. Assange as a high-tech terrorist, and seeking access to the Twitter account of Icelandic legislator Birgitta Jonsdottir due to her past ties to WikiLeaks. Were he charged and found guilty under the Espionage Act, Assange could face the death penalty. Prior to that, the case of PFC Bradley Manning, the U-soldier accused of providing U.S. government documents to WikiLeaks, provides an illustration of the treatment that Assange might expect while in custody. Manning has been subjected to repeated and prolonged solitary confinement, harassment by guards, and humiliating treatment such as being forced to strip naked and stand at attention outside his cell. These are additional reasons that your government should grant Mr. Assange political asylum. We also call on you to grant Mr. Assange political asylum because the crime that he has committed is that of practicing journalism. He has revealed important crimes against humanity committed by the U.S. government, most notably in releasing video footage from an Apache helicopter of a 2007 incident in which the U.S. military appears to have deliberately killed civilians, including two Reuters employees. WikiLeaks release of thousands of U.S. State Department cables revealed important cases of U.S. officials acting to undermine democracy and human rights around the world. Because this is a clear case of an attack on press freedom and on the public's right to know important truths about U.S. foreign policy, and because the threat to his health and well-being is serious, we urge you to grant Mr. Assange political asylum. Thank you for your consideration of our request. Michael Moore, film director. Danny Glover, film director. Oliver Stone, film director. Bill Maher, comedian, television host. Naomi Wolf, author. Daniel Ellsberg, Vietnam War whistleblower. Glenn Greenwald, constitutional lawyer and columnist, Salon.com. Noam Chomsky, linguist, philosopher, author. Patch Adams, MD, physician, activist, author. Chris Hedges, journalist. Jemima Khan, writer and campaigner. Colleen Rowley, retired FBI agent and whistleblower. Anne Wright, U.S. Army colonel, retired, and former U.S. diplomat. Ray McGovern, former U.S. Army officer and senior CIA analyst, retired. Thomas Drake, NSA whistleblower, Bill of Rights activist. Linda Lewis, board member, Whistleblower Support Fund. Kent Spriggs, Guantanamo Habeas Counsel. Jesselyn Radialak, Government Accountability Project. Jacob Applebaum, developer, The Tor Project. Mark Weisbrot, co-director, Center for Economic and Policy Research.
And that, the text of the letter delivered to the Ecuador embassy in London, where Julian Assange is presently ensconced while awaiting word on his appeal for asylum to Ecuador in order to avoid the extradition that is possible to Sweden and then the United States. And we will follow up on the developments regarding this petition with Robert Naiman of justforeignpolicy.org in a future edition of 5 o'clock Shadow. This program is on the Pacifica Radio Network, originating from WBAI. I'm Robert Knight in New York. The other major story of the day, of course, is the Supreme Court ruling on the Affordable Care Act, known as Obamacare, that guarantees the financial health of the insurance industry. We are now joined by Clark Newhall. He is the executive director of Health Justice. He is also an attorney and a physician. And Clark, I understand that you see this decision and this politics, this rhetoric, this controversy, this plan, not in the way that conventional media mostly is portraying it as a battle between Democrats and Republicans, but more one of the corporate lobby versus the public health needs of America. Is that a fair assessment?
That's a very accurate assessment. I think that the left, right, liberal, conservative continuum paradigm that we're also used to talking in is no longer applicable in 21st century American politics. The new ideology is ascendant is sort of at right angles to this left-right paradigm, and you can see it beautifully in the you can see it beautifully in the way in which this decision came down. In that Justice Roberts, the most smarmy of the conservatives on the Supreme Court. Well, maybe not the most. I suppose Clarence Thomas beats him out. Joined with the four liberals on the court to uphold the essential feature of the Affordable Care Act that made it palatable and a giant bailout for insurance companies. So that's a clear, I think, demonstration of the corporatist ideology that is replacing what used to be the liberal conservative continuum.
Can you tell us, with this plan that does not include all Americans and that does not bring a single-payer system to it. That can you tell us where the money goes and who gets served? How is this able to be described as yet another corporate boondoggle or boon?
Well, that's pretty easy. I think we can start with the basics. One of the basics that I think everyone can agree on is that it would not be possible for the health insurance industry to continue to raise premiums at a rate exceeding inflation for the next decade, as they have done for the past decade. You simply could not have an industry that survived if it raised its rates, its prices, that much over a long period of time. That, and then also the observation that it's bad PR and bad corporate governance that combine to give the people who run the health insurance companies $200 million bonuses in light of the lack of health insurance and health care for some 40 million Americans. I don't think anybody except maybe the $200 million men would seriously disagree with me when I say that those two things point to an industry that would have to change its practices or die. Now, no industry that makes as much money as the health insurance industry wants to change its practices, and it certainly doesn't want to die. So they came up with an ingenious scheme whereby they create an entire new market of forced consumers, forced buyers of their shoddy product, all of whom have to buy at their inflated prices. And many, in fact, most of whom will receive government subsidies to buy their shoddy product. It's as if you were told that you have to deposit your money into J.P. Morgan Chase that just lost $2 billion, some say $9 billion of money. You have to deposit your money into J.P. Morgan Chase or pay a fine. It's exactly the same thing.
There's another issue here, and that is, and I'd like your insight as a physician, the escalating costs that you refer to, is that not because of the price of new, better technology and patient care services? How can the entrepreneurialization of medicine be brought into a less exponential cost?
Well, until we had a massive private health insurance industry that was created by the expansion of companies that provided health insurance as a middleman between government and employers and the individual, until we had a massive health insurance industry, we didn't have healthcare inflation at the rates that we've seen it in the past 25 or 30 years. But we can't deny that healthcare, as it increases in complexity, increases in cost, and over the past many years, the complexity has increased at a rate greater than we can probably sustain. At least in terms of cost. So how do we rein that in? Well, we look to the example of other countries. And in particular, we look to, let's say, Taiwan, where healthcare spending based entirely on the Medicare model that we invented in this country, based entirely on that model, healthcare spending is not growing at the rate that it grows in this country, and the administrative overhead for Taiwan's healthcare spending is something around 1%. That's true of most countries with something approaching universal government-controlled healthcare. The costs do not expand at the rate that we see them expand in our country.
Doctor,
the article that described this very clearly was published a couple years ago. It was entitled, "It's the Premium, Stupid." In other words, yes, there's other things that drive health care, but what drives the cost of health care more than anything is the cost of the insurance scam that lies on top of it.
Mm. Dr. Newhall, how would a single-payer system counteract some of these problems?
Well, first of all, and most obviously, a single-payer system is a huge purchaser of goods and services. So that the goods that you provide, that you need for healthcare, pharmaceuticals as a good example, would be purchased at a price that's negotiated with the pharmaceutical company rather than at the price that the pharmaceutical company wishes to charge. A good example of how this works is the Veterans Administration system. The VA is a single payer. In fact, the VA is the paradigm socialized medicine operation, because the doctors, the hospitals, the facility, everything is owned by the government and run by the government. All right. In the VA system, pharmaceuticals cost something like 40% less, cost the system, the VA hospitals, something like 40% less than people pay through their private insurers or at the pharmacy. Why? Because the VA is a huge purchaser, and they can negotiate a lower price. Same thing is true for any other supplier. When you have a large purchaser on one side, that purchaser has enough clout to make the prices reasonable.
I'd like to thank you for the insight, Dr. Clark Newhall of Health Justice. How can people reach your organization and learn more about your serious complaints and astute analysis of this as a corporate initiative?
We have some videos on our website, www.health-justice.org, videos that I made with Mike Farrell, the guy that played B.J. Honeycutt in MASH, that explain what Medicare for All is all about. And if you go to www.health-justice.org, you can find the videos.
Well, thank you so much for being with us today on 5 O'Clock Shadow, Dr. Clark Newhall of Health Justice. This is 5 O'Clock Shadow. I'm Robert Knight in New York, and we're on the Pacifica Network, originating at WBAI. And we're now joined by Dr. David Himmelstein. And he is with the Harvard Medical School and is a co-founder of the organization Physicians for a National Health Program. And Dr. Himmelstein, we've been speaking about the upstream errors that might have been made with the so-called Affordable Care Act, the lack of a single payer, the issue of the mandate, and the fact that people will remain uninsured with variable levels of protection. And can you elaborate now on what this legislation means for ordinary people, poor people, migrant people, and those of limited means?
I should first say I'm also at City University of New York School of Public Health. So hi to fellow New Yorkers. For folks who are undocumented, the legislation actually probably makes things worse because they're not eligible for any of the coverage under this plan. And some of the funding that's helped pay for their care at public hospitals and safety net providers has actually been cut. So for people who are going to remain uninsured, and there are 26 million who are going to remain uninsured, things are probably going to be worse off under this health reform than they've been up till now. Poor people who are eligible will get Medicaid. So there's a big Medicaid expansion, and that'll help some people, some poor people, particularly in states that have had really lousy Medicaid programs. New York State has had one of the best Medicaid programs in the country. But a lot of states like Alabama and Mississippi have not covered many of the poor under Medicaid. And in those places, there'll be an expansion of coverage. The question is, will you actually be able to get care if you've got Medicaid? Because so few doctors take Medicaid in many regions of the country, and it's often really second or third class care. So yes, you'll have coverage. Will you be able to get care? Hard to say. For people who have private insurance today, the president was fond of saying, if you have coverage and you like it, you can keep it. What he doesn't say is if you have coverage today and you don't like it, you have to keep it. So if your employer offers you coverage and it's lousy coverage, basically you're locked into that under this law, and that won't change. For people who aren't getting employer coverage but are too high income to qualify for Medicaid, they'll some of them be eligible for a little bit of a subsidy to help buy private coverage. But if you're four times the poverty level income, there's no subsidy. You just have to buy the coverage yourself, and that can be extraordinarily expensive. So we're talking about something like $12,000, $14,000, even $20,000 a year as the cost of coverage for a family of four. And 400 times poverty, 400% of poverty, sounds like a lot of money, but actually it could be 15-20% of total income for folks to buy coverage. So there'll be some subsidies for relatively low-income people, but for the rest of middle-class, working-class Americans, the law says buy coverage, and it's going to be lousy coverage. The kind of coverage we're talking about is $2,000 deductible, so nothing gets paid until you've already spent $2,000, and then you pay 20% of the costs after that until you've paid $5,000. So, I guess the summary is, for undocumented folks, things are worse. For the very poor, many will get Medicaid, and for some that'll help. For others, it won't be worth much. For most working and middle-class Americans, things will not change very much. And for the private insurance industry, things will get much better. There's $1 trillion in this for the private insurance company.
You seem to be painting the picture that we are moving from an epoch of racial discrimination, from one of economic discrimination, now to one of health discrimination or triage.
Well, I think that's been increasingly true in this country over the last several decades, and unfortunately this law doesn't change that. It really tries to cement in place a multi-class system of care with a lot of people on the bottom and 1% at the top.
Where have we heard that before? We're speaking with Dr. David Himmelstein. And, Doctor, I remember in the early days of the implementation of this law that the Obama administration was very alacritous and generous in granting exemptions to major corporations in the low-level service industry, this so-called McDonald's echelon of companies that had many very low-wage workers. And will there be that kind of exemptions continuing for corporate employers, and what does that mean for the workers?
We don't know, because most of this law won't go into effect until 2014. So a lot of the details of how it's going to be implemented, we just don't know at this point, and won't for another year and a half. What we do know is that employers and insurance companies are already getting around many of the provisions in this law and have plans to get around more. So there's a regulation in this that says insurance companies can't have more than 15% overhead in the group market, 20% in the individual market. That's already outrageous when you consider Medicaid runs for 3% overhead. Why are we paying the middlemen 12% more than that? But beyond that, employers who are self-insured, they're not subject to that regulation at all, even though it may look like Aetna coverage or Blue Cross coverage to the workers. In fact, if the employer has what's called a self-insured plan, and something like half of all employers in this country, that's the kind of coverage they've got. Those regulations don't apply. And some of the regulations on how much you can vary the premium based on the person who's covered, age and that sort of thing, those things also probably don't apply, won't apply to employer coverage. So we're already seeing some of the regulations in this beginning to be skirted, and there's a lot of discussion in the health insurance literature about how you can get around the regulations and what schemes are going to be used. And frankly, we're already beginning to see the return of the HMOs of the 1980s. One of the things that was called for in this legislation is what's called accountable care organizations. And that's really just a rebranding of the old HMO concept. And here it comes again with your employer locking you into a narrow set of providers who have their own financial interest in denying you care. So I think we're in for an ugly time ahead.
Well, time will tell whether this will be a cap in the feather of feather in the cap of the legacy of people like Barack Obama and Justice Roberts, or whether it will be an albatross for the public. And we count on your insight as we move forward with this story and also look at what happened to the people who claim to be in Congress supporting single payer and making sure all Americans are protected. So thank you so much for your thoughtful words today, Dr. David Himmelstein. And tell people how they can follow your work.
Well, they can find us on the web at pnhp.org. That's the website for Physicians for National Health Program. My work and the work of many other colleagues is represented there, pnhp.org. Thanks very much.
Thank you for being with us today on 5 O'Clock Shadow. And that concludes this edition of 5 O'Clock Shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network, originating at WBAI, where today's program was produced by Thiago Barroso and engineered by Michael G. Haskins. We welcome your insights and comments with an email to theshadow@wbai.org. And for 5 O'Clock Shadow, I'm Robert Knight in New York.